This is the son of PC JJ.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome again to another edition of the International Happy Station Show. I'm Keith Parent, as you probably have guessed, and if you haven't, well, that's me. That's K-E-I-T-H, last name P-E-R-R-O-N, and some of my Latin American friends think it's Perón, like Evita Perón. Evita no es mi tía. No, she is not my auntie, and as there's no relation whatsoever. Anyway, on today's program, we have a very exciting show. We're going to be talking to someone who is very well known in the world of international broadcasting. He does a weekly show that airs at the four corners of the earth. I'm not going to tell you right away what it is, but maybe, just maybe, our first piece of music will be a clue. Well, this show, by the way, has been on for, well, I would guess now more than 50 years. And for more than 40 of those years, it began with this, Take the A-Train, now performed by the Skymasters.
Thank you.
From Holland, the Skymasters with Duke Ellington's Take the A-Train. Now, as you may remember at the beginning of the show, I said that, well, for more than 40 years, this was a very well-known piece because for more than 40 years, it was the opening of a very well-known jazz show that aired around the world on The Voice of America, and it began like this.
Time for jazz. Willis Conover in Washington, D.C. with The Voice of America Jazz Hour.
That was Willis Conover introducing the Jazz Hour on The Voice of America. Now, for those of you who don't know who Willis Conover is, we now bring you this report from Wayne Bowman of the VOA.
This is The Voice of America Jazz Hour.
With his deep baritone voice, Willis Conover brought jazz into the homes of listeners around the world, inspiring the next generation of stars. His daily hour-long jazz broadcast on The Voice of America was especially meaningful for those who tuned in from behind the Iron Curtain. Conover's Jazz Hour was, for many, the only exposure to music from the West. Alexei Kozlov is the founder of the popular Russian jazz ensemble Arsenal. As a university architecture student, he says, he was led by Conover into the world of jazz, inspiring him to learn to play the saxophone.
Despite the forbiddance of Voice of America programming in Soviet countries, we still listened to Voice of America, putting ourselves and our families in real danger. We learned everything from Conover. While there was propaganda against everything American, Conover was the one who made America to be appealing and desirable for everyone who listened.
Conover's Jazz Hour provided a platform for household names in the West, like Duke Ellington, Charlie Parker, and Count Basie, to be introduced to East European audiences. But for fledgling musicians, his show also provided an education in the art of jazz, helping them make the transition from passive listeners to active participants in the music. Viktor Fonerjof from Latvia is now a professional bass player in the United States. He was introduced to Conover's program while attending Aviation College in Riga.
Every evening, I tried to sneak into the only classroom that had a radio player. Everyone at home was asleep, so they didn't know I was gone. Otherwise, I would have been grounded for listening to the prohibited programming.
From 1955 until his death in 1996, Conover worked from his small studio in Washington. From here, under clouds of cigarette smoke, he projected his love of jazz to the world.
I could have never imagined in a million years that someday I'd been standing at the actual studio of Willis Conover, the legend, that I'd actually be in the studio from which Conover talked about jazz in his charming velvet voice.
FM Drucker is a producer at VOA. He worked in that very studio with Conover for 8 years. While still in Russia, Drucker became an avid listener of the Jazz Hour. After immigrating to the United States, he sought employment with the radio host he admired so much. Drucker says Conover devoted his life to the Jazz Hour. He says Conover and his staff worked long hours to ensure that the VOA audience heard music of the highest quality.
Он был очень педантичным в смысле качества.
It was very precise, detail-oriented. We didn't have CDs then, we had vinyl records, and so if there was even a small scratch of a sound, he asked me to cut them off. Sometimes I'd spend a full day cutting out the scratches. But it was worth it, the sound was impeccable. And that's how Conover's music was remembered in Russia, impeccable and magical.
Conover's attention to detail and his knack for explaining jazz to the masses may never be replicated. But in an interview near the end of his career, he seemed to feel he had accomplished his own individual goals.
What I want to do is something that makes me feel that my life was worthwhile. And I think I will feel that way on my last day.
Jazz is now taught and performed around the world, and among those who are now the teachers of today's jazz stars are faces from the former Soviet Union. In achieving his own dream, Willis Conover helped others achieve theirs. For producers Elisa Krutovsky and Svetlana Prudovsky, Wayne Bowman, VOA News.
And that report came to us courtesy of the Voice of America, looking at legendary broadcaster Willis Conover, who for more than 40 years hosted the Jazz Hour around the world on shortwave on the VOA. Well, the jazz tradition on the Voice of America has continued. Willis Conover passed away in the mid-1990s, and for a number of years after he died, they replayed some of his old shows until they found a replacement. The replacement is New York-based broadcaster Russ Davis, who took over the reins in 1999 and now hosts Jazz America on shortwave, medium wave, satellite, and the internet. Recently, I had a chance to speak with him, and we now bring you that conversation.
Many, many years ago, there was an announcer who went on the air, and all he did was mutter the words, "This is jazz," on the Voice of America. That was followed by Duke Ellington's Take the A-Train. Now, there's many of you right now who probably know who I'm talking about, and that is the legendary Voice of America broadcaster, Willis Conover, who continued doing that show until the mid-1990s when he passed away in the month of May around 1996. Well, the jazz tradition has continued on the VOA. The show now is called Jazz America. And joining us at his home studio, if I can say that, all the way in New York City, is Russ Davis. Hello, Russ.
Hello, Keith. And yes, you're correct. This is my home studio office, and I love working in my own space here. And if this were video, you'd see 7,000 CDs on a wall behind me. I still use a lot of CDs, and I love being surrounded by all of these things and having my own little studio. It's a new world, my friend. You and I have done broadcasting for a few years, and we now have to be our own engineers as well as our own presenters and programmers. So it's a great situation to be in. I really, really enjoy working in my own space here. But be aware that there's some construction going on next door. We may hear some rumbling.
Well, you know, it's kind of amazing when you think about it, because Willis Conover presented the jazz show on the VOA for many years. And for all that time, he was in a studio in Washington with a technician, a production assistant, probably a whole group of other people as well. And today, you know, we can do radio in the most simple of environments.
No doubt about it. In fact, I work with Voice of America as an independent contractor, as Willis did as well. He had a different situation. I'll tell you a funny story about that. But in addition to that, I do other programs for other people from time to time. I've done programs for Jazz FM in England and for Bay FM 78 in the Tokyo Bay Area and for other stations around the world. And also, I have my own online radio channel called Moja Radio, M-O-J-A, mojaradio.com for modern jazz. And so all of those things come from this one little spot, and I'm the only person involved in doing it. Now, with Willis, he had a very interesting situation. You know, he did his program for over 40 years, and he did it from that studio in Washington, D.C., in the VOA offices. Well, he was not an employee of the U.S. government. He was an independent contractor, but he was so powerful that he commandeered a studio space and got all of these people to help him and do his work with him. And one day an auditor walked in and said, "Who is this guy? He's not on our list." Somehow he was basically breaking the law by having that office, but he was such an influential and powerful figure that they just kind of overlooked the rules and let Willis go as he would. And that's the power of jazz, my friend.
Well, it certainly is. Now, when you started doing Jazz America, because of the history of jazz on the VOA and Willis Conover, was it going through the back of your mind, you know, did you ever think, how am I going to fill those shoes? How am I going to fill that void?
Keith, you better believe I thought about that, because as being a jazz radio presenter and programmer since 1978, and everyone in the industry knew Willis's name. Now, people inside the United States of America did not, because at that point there was no internet broadcasting, it was only terrestrial broadcasting. So by law and the charter of the VOA, it was illegal for people to broadcast VOA, reproduce them in inside the USA. So nobody knew him, but we in the industry knew him. So I knew what a legendary figure he was. And when I heard that they had run out of playing his old programs and they were looking for a new presenter, a friend of mine who worked in Washington, D.C. and had a friend at VOA said, well, you should apply for this. And I said, well, you know, I know Willis Conover, and I knew he was a 100% straight ahead, in other words, very traditional jazz programmer and presenter. And I was involved and aware of and conversant with not only straight ahead traditional jazz, but I also leaned a lot in the work that I had done with contemporary jazz or modern jazz and even electric jazz, something I think that Willis would have turned his back on. And I didn't think they really wanted someone like me. So when I said, well, why not? You know, I have some international experience and I work in New York and I've worked in different markets. So why not? I'll just give it a shot. I discovered that John Stevenson, one of the heads of English Broadcasting, who was in charge of bringing on board a new jazz presenter, he was interested in someone who had that awareness and would modernize the style of jazz on VOA. And so because of that and my international experience, they brought me in. But it was a daunting task because I knew that a lot of people who'd listened to Willis over the years were probably going to be expecting that purely traditional presentation, and that wasn't something I was going to present. So I was not sure I was going to be accepted, but luckily over the years now, and I've been doing this since 1999, I've had broad acceptance from both factions of the jazz fandom, if you will, those who will accept modern and even embrace modern jazz, and those who are traditionalists.
When you started the show, did you start the show in New York, or were you just going back and forth between Washington?
No, I've always done it from New York. I was also working with a satellite radio company based in Washington, D.C., so I was back and forth quite often between the two, but I always produced it, and that was part of the agreement. They did not want to have another situation where someone was going to be coming in using their facilities and their studio. So it was mandated that I had to have my own studio, and that was fine with me. I already had it in place. And Washington and New York City is where I've produced the program 100% of the time.
This past weekend when I was tuning in, because Jazz Americas is heard here in Asia on medium wave, shortwave, and you can also pick it up on the internet. And the VOA being a powerhouse, what it is, the shortwave frequencies for the VOA are booming here. I mean, literally booming. And that's an understatement.
It was
an interesting show because you were talking about the mixture of jazz and classical music.
Yes.
And that is something that your approach to Jazz America being so different. As much as I respect Willis Conover and I listened to his show for many years, your show really covers a broader spectrum of jazz. Because if you say jazz, you can't really narrow it into just one, you know, specific type, because there's so many types.
Yes, sir. You know that's right, Keith. And here's part of the reason for that. Willis was covering basically the big band era and the great singers, and he loved them deeply in the standards and how those standards pop songs of the day had been turned into jazz pieces and those great big bands. I mean, come on, Duke Ellington, Take the A-Train was his theme song, and all those wonderful singers, Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, etc. He started basically in that area, Louis Armstrong and the first recordings of the 30s, basically, and he went up to bebop and a little bit beyond. Okay, so we're talking about a spectrum of, in general, generally speaking, about four decades. For me, I'll play Louis Armstrong, I'll play Billie Holiday, I'll play Bessie Smith if I can find anything. I'll play the first recordings of jazz, but right next to it, I'll play something from 2010. So I'm talking about 80 years that I'm covering, because jazz, like any other art form, has gone through an evolution and continues to evolve. So many jazz purists have, as and you laughed when I said this in the beginning, that I would actually have the audacity to play electric jazz. Many jazz purists don't believe that jazz can be made with electric instruments. Well, au contraire, mon frère, it can, because to me, part of the definition of jazz is that it is improvised music. And if it is improvised, then it can be played on an oud, it can be played on a harp, it can be played on an electric guitar, it can be played on an electric keyboard, just like it can be played on a saxophone, a trumpet, a clarinet, an acoustic piano, or any other acoustic instrument. So the fact that that is true, and that it is a wonderful American-born art form of international elements, but now the international jazz and improvised music scene is so alive, and we have the ability to share our different styles with one another from all over the world. Well, it's one of the most exciting times in jazz history, so why in the world would I limit the scope of what I would be playing? I have so much to choose from, not only the eight decades, but also the many styles from literally all over the world.
Weather report in Teen Town from the album Heavy Weather here on the Happy Station Show. And I should mention to you that if you go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com, and click on Jazz for the Asking, our bi-weekly jazz program, you can hear the full interview. Now, why are we bringing you the full interview on this show? Well, we're only 55 minutes. Jazz for the Asking is 2 hours, and you can hear the full interview as well as some more of this wonderful music. We now continue with our conversation with Russ Davis.
from your point of view, I mean, if you look back at a lot of the jazz recordings from the, especially the 50s and 60s, the producer was just as big a star as the artists that were performing. What about today? Does the producer still have, on newer jazz recordings, as an important role as, let's say, Norman Gans, for example, or others?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Keith. You know, some of the famous ones, well, even engineers who also had the function of being a producer, Rudy Van Gelder,
right,
oversaw all those fantastic recordings right across the river from here in Manhattan, over in New Jersey at his awesome studio that so many of the most famous prestige and Blue Note recordings of all time, he oversaw those things. So in essence, he was the producer, though he was really an engineer. Rudy Van Gelder worked with Creed Taylor, who was a producer and the owner of his record label, and they had a specific idea of the kind of things they wanted to do. And quite often they would have a rhythm section and then just bring in the leaders and rehearse the music, and they were in charge, and the leaders just listened to what the engineers and producers were telling them to do. Teo Macero, who did so many of Miles Davis's most famous works. Miles would go in and just play in a free manner, sometimes for over an hour, and then Teo Macero would sit down literally with a razor blade and cut those songs that have become so famous down to 25, 20, 18, 15-minute pieces, and that just doesn't happen anymore. To answer your question specifically, much more today, the artists themselves are being their own producer and director of their entire career. Just as you and I are in charge of 100% of our productions and our programming, that's the way it is for artists these days. And I believe that the producer has a much less important place simply because of the numbers of artists that are taking their own careers by the horn. And directing their own careers. It's partly because of economics. There aren't the big record labels that are out there that used to be in existence. There are just so few of them because of economics. They had to go out of business. Nobody was buying records and CDs anymore. They were getting their music through downloads, and they just aren't available. For example, there is, on the island of Manhattan, where I live, only one huge record shop you can go to that has a massive jazz section. There is no other record store in New York City where you can go and look over thousands of CDs to buy the music. It just doesn't exist. So no stores and no record companies to speak of, just very few. And the producers used to work for the record labels, and they brought in all the people on their roster and recorded them. Well, that just really doesn't exist anymore. So the answer to your question is producers are certainly not as important as they used to be. It's all on the shoulders of the artist himself or herself.
A few years ago, I watched a documentary on German television about Blue Note Records and about the guys from Germany who went to the United States as immigrants and created Blue Note Records. And the thing about Blue Note that always was, for me, I always thought was very special, wasn't just the recording itself, but also the packaging. And they were interviewing some of the sound technicians and musicians that recorded with the two guys. And they said, you know, both of them were from Germany. They had no rhythm whatsoever. They would be in the studio snapping their fingers and tapping their feet completely out of time to what was being played. But they said they knew exactly what they wanted.
Well, that's the worst kind of client to have. Someone who doesn't know what they want until they hear it. that's so interesting. That says a couple of things. They were businessmen, but they were open to artistic things. And as long as they didn't suppress the real desires of the artists, everything was going to be okay. And obviously they did not. They gave them carte blanche to do what they felt like they wanted to do musically, because they couldn't go in and alter it. They couldn't go in and make suggestions. They just had to sit and enjoy it. So that's a great story.
One of the producers said that one of the funniest moments was Alfred Lion getting on the talkback button, talking to the musicians with a very heavy German accent, telling them what he would like to hear, how he wants the feeling to come across. They just looked at each other and went, okay.
but they said there was something, the
musician that they spoke to said there was something about working with the two of them. They said that, like you just mentioned, they gave them the freedom to do what they want, but they also knew what they wanted to hear themselves, because both of them were jazz fans.
Well, maybe they were trying to express a style they wanted to exhibit on Blue Note, just like the covers were going to be so sophisticated and so creative. They had a certain style in mind that they wanted the music to project, a certain style they wanted to have in Blue Note recordings. I can understand that to a certain extent. I mentioned Creed Taylor before. Creed Taylor was an A&M Records producer and decided he wanted to make jazz more popular. So he was going. He had a very specific idea of the style of recordings that he wanted to have on his label. And there wasn't going to be a broad spectrum of styles. It was going to be in a certain pocket. So he brought in Don Sobieski as his arranger, and he made sure that Wes Montgomery and Hubert Laws and George Benson and Freddie Hubbard, they all had a certain sort of sound and style to those recordings, and it helped keep jazz popular at a time when lots of folks thought it was sort of aimless in style. So I think the Alfred Lions and et cetera, they had a specific idea of what the kind of sound they wanted. And for the most part, in the beginning especially, they had that small group acoustic sound that was going to happen, and it was very, very solid. And then they allowed others to develop, like soul jazz and modal jazz and free jazz, and all those other things evolved. But in the beginning, they had a very specific idea of the kind of sound they wanted. That's probably what he was saying over that that speaker in the studio.
What about Chet Baker? And I bring this up because just 2 weeks ago, I have many vinyl discs. I don't even want to tell you how many I have. And I came across one that I totally forgot that I bought it in 1995. It was a reissue of Chet Baker playing with, of all things, a Herb Alpert-style mariachi band. I love Chet Baker, but it's like this stuff is dreadful. And the description on the album, it's odd because he was living in Europe when it was recorded. All the tracks were laid in Los Angeles. They sent the tracks to Europe, where he laid down his flugelhorn. He wasn't even in the studio with the musicians, and he doesn't really play. He just plays little sections here and there. And I'm thinking, you know, either he did this because he was using a lot of drugs at the time, that, or he needed the money.
Oh my goodness! Well, As my wife and I have told our daughter since she was old enough to understand what we were saying, everybody makes mistakes. So I think probably your instincts are probably correct, Keith. He was under the influence of a lot of very strong. He was an addicted person, and it's one of the sad things in jazz history. I've spoken to folks like Roy Haynes, the great drummer, who was there as a young guy in the heyday of bebop. And he played with Charlie Parker, and he played with Miles Davis, and he played with those other guys and Chet Baker, who were all under the influence of not only alcohol, but heroin. And some of them never lived to be as old as they should have been because of that. It's pretty obvious, some of them. And he wouldn't even talk about it very much. He said it was just a scourge. So I'm afraid that Chet Baker was certainly, he had such a wonderful natural style. His musical spirit was so strong, but the rest of him was so weak, and he couldn't fight that addiction. And it's a tragedy.
He was also a great vocalist.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. And it really came from his soul and his spirit, his unique style too. The fact that he had that Oklahoma drawl and that sort of Southern sensibility, but at the same time, that West Coast sophistication and people just loved his sound. It was so accessible and easy to listen to and take in, and still at the same time adventurous. I mean, you know, he was part of the cool jazz revolution, and just a wonderful style of jazz that came from the West Coast. He and Jerry Mulligan together were just fantastic. And Chico Hamilton was a great drummer that worked with them. And I've known some other people that worked with him too, John Scofield and Dave Samuels and other modern musicians. And they said, those guys were just a wreck. They made great music, but they were so addicted, it was difficult to be around them.
Now, Jazz America airs around the world. Do you find a difference in the response that you get, let's say, from listeners overseas to a show that, let's say, you would do in the United States?
Well, yeah, I suppose so. I do believe there is a constant that runs, a thread that runs through all jazz fans. They resonate to that element in it that I've mentioned before, the freedom of the music. Some people just need their music very structured and in a certain specific style, and they're rigid in the way they want their music to be, no matter what the style may be. And I find that jazz fans all over the world, be they Americans or international, resonate to the freedom in the music and are much more open. But I will say that the international audience is more completely open, I think, than American audiences are, and more open to improvised and even freer styles of music. They can hear and take in more easily a more experimental or avant-garde style of jazz than Americans can. Americans seem to, and this is a generalization, please don't take it as an absolute. In a general sense, Americans are so used to a simpler arrangement, if you will, and more of a blues-based style of jazz and more structured form of jazz than the international audience, which loves the groove and the simple, funky blues and swing of traditional jazz, but they also like it avant-garde. So if I were going to separate the two, I would say that the international audience is more open to a freer style of jazz. And I think that can be proven to a certain extent by the number of American artists who make their living touring Asia and Europe as opposed to the United States, which is really more of a pop and rock audience. And the numbers of jazz fans is lower than the pop and rock fans, whereas internationally, it's more, I'll put under the huge umbrella of simply music fans. I think that the international audience, from what I can tell, could listen to a classical music concert in a traditional way, or a jazz concert, or a hip-hop concert, or a techno concert, and be just as happy. They wouldn't even differentiate. It's just music, whereas Americans may be a little bit more prejudiced with the kind of music they personally like, and they don't want to expand their horizons as much as the international audience does.
Do you think also part of that could be that in many of these countries, if we take, let's say, Eastern Europe, where, you know, during the Cold War, jazz was illegal and banned in many Eastern European countries and in other parts of the world, do you think that may have a part in it?
Yes, I think so. Obviously, with Willis Conover, that was the main thrust of his presentation, and that was the audience that he reached more directly than any other audience in the world. The Eastern European audience was hungry for the freedom of jazz, and he really served it up to them. Now, with Eastern Europe, it's developed. They have their own jazz radio stations everywhere. It's not that foreign thing that is almost unattainable. Now it's easily attainable. And instead, VOA's Jazz America, which I present, not only goes by shortwave and internet, but also we present it to and offer it to radio stations all around the world to accept. If they have a satellite dish, they can take in the feed and rebroadcast it anytime they like. And that is what happens with a lot of Eastern European radio stations in countries not only there but around the world. Now, those that listen on shortwave, the ones that don't have that infrastructure that more developed countries in Europe and other parts of the world have, they still listen. That audience is responding to me, I think, like the Eastern European audience used to respond to Willis. For example, a large portion of my email communication comes from Africa. African countries don't have the infrastructure quite often that other countries do, and so they're still picking it up on shortwave, and those are the folks that are my Eastern Europe, if you will. So it's an interesting thing that's happened down through the years.
Russ Davis from Jazz America, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Keith, it's been my great, great pleasure, and the only problem I've had here is that your voice is so infinitely more resonant and perfect than mine. I'm jealous. So you have a great presentation, I can tell, and thanks for having me on your program. It really was a joy.
Louis Armstrong with Ole Miss Blues here on the International Happy Station. Before that, I was speaking with Russ Davis, host of Jazz America on The Voice of America. To find out the frequencies and how you can listen, just do a search in Google for The Voice of America.
Jazz America, and you'll get a link. I also invite you to check out Russ Davis's own website called Moja. The URL is russdavismoja.com. That's russdavismoja, all one word, .com. If you didn't have time to write that down, don't worry. If you go to our website, pcjmedia.com, you'll have the links for the two websites. We still have time for one more piece of music. This is actually one of my favorites, one of my favorite jazz recordings of all time. It features legendary jazz organist Jimmy Smith. The album was released in 1964 on Verve. It's called The Cat, The Incredible Jimmy Smith. And you'll know why it is one of my favorites. You're listening to the International Happy Station Show. Jimmy Smith and The Cat from the album The Cat, The Incredible Jimmy Smith. Something actually that I forgot to mention a moment ago, the full interview with Russ Davis is used on the most recent edition of Jazz for the Asking. But so if you go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com, click on Jazz for the Asking, you'll find the full interview there. It's absolutely fantastic. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. And we have some great music on that show as well. Now, before we go, I want to tell you about the upcoming edition of Media Network Plus. We have a survey running on the Media Network Plus page of PCJ. And this is going to be a very interactive show because We are going to be discussing shortwave broadcasting in the first part of the show with you in mind, meaning you, the listener, are going to make your comments known. I'm tripping over my words. Yes, you're going to make your comments known. Just go out and fill out the survey. If you already filled out the survey, unfortunately, you cannot fill it out again. But it's very, very simple. Just go to the Media Network Plus page at PCJ. Click on the survey, and the first question in the survey is, who do you think is to blame for the decline in shortwave broadcasting from the West? You have six choices. The second question is, can these decisions meaning cutting back in shortwave broadcasting, can they be reversed? And then the final one is, if you can sit down with the management, staff, and governments of international broadcasters, what would you tell them? We actually have some fascinating comments that have already come in, and we'll be discussing that and much more on the next edition of Media Network Plus, including, yes, including an interview with Eric Koch. Who's that, you may say? Well, Eric Koch was one of the first announcers in the German section of the CBC International Service way back in 1944. Eric Koch, our special guest on Media Network Plus, he was one of the first announcers of the German section in 1944. An absolutely fascinating insight to what was going on at the International Service. And if you don't know what the CBC International Service is or was, today it's known as Radio Canada International. Anyway, with that, we've come to the end of this edition of the program. If you would like to get in touch with us, our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. That's pcjmedia@gmail.com. And of course, our website, once again, www.pcjmedia.com. I'm going to stop, giving it out right now because I have to go. Yes, I have to go. So, on behalf of our technician, Kevin Lee, Johan Backer, who just returned from holiday a few days ago, this is Keith Perron, all the way in Taipei, Taiwan, saying so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and of course, sayonara.